Bon, merci beaucoup. Ma présentation sera en anglais, mais je veux commencer par quelques remarques en français. Je voudrais tout d'abord remercier le professeur Petit pour me donner l'opportunité de présenter mes idées ici. C'est un grand honneur. J'ai une longue histoire d'amour avec la France, particulièrement avec la ville de Paris. J'ai vécu à Paris pendant 2 années très marquantes de mon adolescence. J'ai passé ici la plus grande aventure musicale de ma vie. Ma formation musicale, que je n'ai jamais tout à fait abandonnée, même si je me considère meilleur scientifique que pianiste, m'a inspiré à aborder la recherche du système d'audition. Et malheureusement, mon français n'est pas suffisamment bon pour présenter tout le séminaire en français. Je vais donc continuer en utilisant la langue internationale. En utilisant la langue internationale actuelle de la science. Ce qui est le mauvais anglais avec un accent étranger. Mes excuses. J'ai fait un grand effort pour préparer ce texte. So, I hope some of the things I'm going to say will actually resonate with the previous presentation. I'm going to present an argument. You'll see the general lines in the next few minutes. To start with, I would like to present the Darwinian aspects of the auditory system, those parts which are not music. Okay, so here's a metaphor for the auditory system. You ask an engineer to build a system that would allow you to know what's out there in the sea. A few millions of years later, the engineer comes back and does the following. He makes 2 ditches, 3 meters long, about 1 meter distant, one from the other. He takes 2 handkerchiefs and put them on the water. And then he tells you, observe the motion of the handkerchiefs going up and down, and you will know what's out there. Okay, this is the auditory system. And a lot of the funny and the possibly unusual aspects of auditory processing that I will try to explain to you have to do with this impossible mission. Just to make it clear that how important are these non-musical functions of the auditory system, I want to bring this picture. This is taken from a street near my home in Jerusalem. It's called Borokhov Street. This is a school for deaf children. And this sign warns the car drivers about the fact that deaf children are crossing the street. Now, you would imagine it's easy to understand why people should be warned about blind people crossing the streets, but why do you need to warn drivers about deaf children crossing the streets? Okay, with a bit of thinking, it's actually clear. I mean, they don't hear from behind. I mean, we hear from behind, so we know the car is coming, but they don't. And crossing the street turns out to be a big problem for people who don't hear. Having said that, what this series of lectures is about music and the brain. So let's start by this, by what we are trying to do when we talk about music and brain. So we have a world of phenomena that belong to the world of music, octave equivalents, musical scales, contour, consonance and dissonance, all kinds of things like that. And we have a world of phenomena that come from the world of that come from brain research. Okay, these are phenomena that people describe that are very important in understanding how sound is analyzed by the brain. And again, the names are unimportant: organization by frequency, modulation spectra. Some of these things have been mentioned during the previous presentation. And we would like to make connections like these. Okay, maybe consonance and dissonance have something to do with something called modulation spectra. That was Helmholtz's idea. Now, there is a big problem when you start doing these kind of things. There is a big problem. Okay, the big problem is that there are really no tones in the ear. At the ear, what happens at the ear are pressure vibrations, which are the total sum of all the things that happen in the world. Okay, the ear doesn't know about what composed these things. As the, in French, English, and Hebrew, there's no difference between the physical things that make vibrations and the perceptual stuff that we have. My friend Jan Schnoop claims that in German there is a distinction. Okay, I don't, but you have, this distinction is extremely important. Sound, as far as I'm concerned at the moment, is time sequence of pressures at the eardrum. So you have a single sound at each ear. Okay, there's no, when you hear my voice and things around you, okay, there's no my voice and the voices of others, the noises of others. What you have is one sequence of air pressures. So a lot of what we call music is created inside the head. And the corollary to that is that music is not in the ears, it's created inside the head. That would be the content of the first part of my talk. And in the second part of my talk, I'll say a few words about the little bit that we understand about how this process is performed. So I'll start in the first part. What I would like to convince you is that you don't hear your ears. Okay, that's the punchline. Okay, so first of all, here's the auditory pathways. Okay, I will not. What I want to impress you by showing this scheme is that there's a lot of auditory processing in the brain. We start in the ear. I'll say quite a lot about what's going on here. And then we go through the lower part of the brain, the brainstem, with a lot of, and these pathways converge and eventually reach auditory cortex, primary auditory cortex, and from there to these higher brain areas referred earlier. So the basic issue and the heart of the problem that the auditory system faces has to do with what the ear does. Okay, so you probably all know we have ears, the external ear, what makes us beautiful, the middle ear, which is the part that is, you know, it exists when you have ear infections, and finally the inner ear, where the air vibrations become electricity. Now, if you take this inner ear, the auditory organ in the inner ear, there are also vestibular organs, but if you take the auditory organ in the inner ear, it is in fact a long tube. The tube is very long, it's too long to be placed straightened out, so whoever designed the ear coiled it around itself, creating this snail-like structure, the cochlea. But the tube is relatively, it looks pretty much the same with small differences I'll mention in a moment along its length. Okay, it's separated into a number of volumes, and the main thing to remember is this membrane that separates between the upper and lower volumes. When we have sounds, the sounds make the tympanic membrane vibrate. This becomes vibration in the fluid, in the salty water which is inside this this tube. This creates vibration of this membrane. On the membrane, we have this extremely beautiful and interesting piece of tissue called the organ of Corti, one of these magical creation of nature, if you wish, a combination of physics, chemistry, biology, order, and chaos that is so characteristic of biological systems. And in it, you have the hair cells. So these are the hairs of the hair cells. Okay, that's a magnified view of the hair cells. You have the hairs. The hairs move in this direction, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, when the membrane moves. Again, a beautiful picture of the hair cells arranged along the basilar membrane. So you have a few tens of thousands of these. And now, one word about this basilar membrane that cuts the tube in two. It's not quite uniform. close to the entrance, close to the middle ear, it's narrow and tight, and far from the its far end, it's wider and less made out of tissue that less tense. And this was already known to Helmholtz, and he hypothesized that this has to do with the separation of complex sounds into frequency components. That's correct. Okay, he imagined the mechanism, which is incorrect, but that's not important at the moment. Already Helmholtz realized that in the 19th century, realized that the first thing that happens in the auditory system is a separation of the sound into its frequency components. So if you present a sound here, this now this is a straightened version of the cochlea with the basilar membrane in the middle. Okay, so if you present a pure tone, you will have vibrations which are maximal at some point where the mechanical properties correspond to the frequency that is played. And the hair cells that are on top here will tell you that the vibration is large. Here and here, the hair cells will not see much vibration, so they will not report to the brain. If you have different frequencies, low frequencies will be represented towards the far end of the cochlea, middle frequency in the middle, and high frequency at close to the beginning. And that's the important thing. If you have a complex sound, in principle, that's a simple view. It's a bit more complicated. You get a vibration of the membrane potential of the basilar membrane at places that correspond to the frequencies that compose the sound. Okay, so that's probably you heard this type of explanation a number of times. And now what I want to tell you is that you don't hear this decomposition at all. Okay, we don't hear our ear. And in order to demonstrate that, I need to give you a crash course on reading spectrograms. Okay, so this is a sound. What did you hear? Okay, people say something fell and broke, something like that. Well, it's not. That's a sound that was generated on a computer. Okay, and it consists of a pure tone with a decreasing frequency and amplitude, followed by what we call the broadband transient, something that includes a lot of frequencies and it's short in time. Now, in order to so this is the so-called oscillogram. What I took here is the sequence of air pressure, and I plotted them. Since it's very, very fast, these vibrations are thousands of times per second, the line goes on top of itself, and so you see this bluish color. Okay? Now, in order to see more what happens in between, what we do is to take a short segment and ask which frequencies contributed to that beat. Okay? Here it's done by something called the Fourier transform. It can be done by in other ways as well. And the Fourier transform tells me that most of this signal is actually a pure tone at a frequency that is slightly below 3,000 hertz. Okay, and then I move a little bit. Okay, and I look at the next segment, and the next segment is mostly a pure tone at a frequency that's slightly lower than that. Okay, and so on and so forth. If I ask the Fourier transform what's the composition of this thing, it tells me a lot of different frequencies. So this is a spectrogram. It's a bit like writing music with standard musical notation. Okay, this is frequency, this is time. Okay, and now that you know how to read a spectrogram, here's a spectrogram of a piece of music, and I'm sure that just looking at it, you can know what it is. Okay. Okay, just in secret, I'll tell you that I can't either. So I will play this thing to you, but what I want to do first is, without music, to show you how the basilar membrane looks when you play this piece of music. So this is a simulation of the basilar membrane, and what you see are the vibration at different bits of the membrane as they occur along while the sound is playing. That's the information that goes into the brain. Before I play to you the whole thing, I want to play to you bits of it, bits that excite different bits of the basilar membrane. So here, for example, I removed from the sound everything except the bit around 2 kilohertz, okay? And I played this sound to the basilar membrane, okay? This is the 2 kilohertz point. Okay? That's a bit near 2 kilohertz that excited the basilar membrane. And can you now tell me what this sound was? No, okay. So here I did the same thing around 600 hertz. Okay, so what is it? Okay. The thing to understand is that the neurons around the hair cells that sit here provide information about the thing that you heard, that you just heard. Okay, they don't provide information about the full sound I will play in a moment. They provide information only about these bits. Here's another bit around 300 hertz. So here it is, okay? It's a piece of song by Brahms. This is the full thing. Okay, and again, this is how the basilar membrane looks now. You saw this big peak that shifted around. That's the fundamental of the voice of the singer. Okay, that's the thing that appears here. Okay, it's this. That's on top of that, you have the vibrato, so which is the usual technique in classical singing. And for example, at 2 kilohertz, what you heard are beat of one harmonic of the vibrato of the singer of one note. Okay, so. What I would like, the responses of the neurons in the early auditory system really follows these bits of sound that fall on different points on the basilar membrane. So here's an example of this. Here I used, it's not Brahms, this is a bird. Okay, just this is a spectrogram. This bird call goes up and down and up and down. Okay, I'm playing it slowly now. Okay, you can hear the frequency trajectory, and I recorded the response of a neuron. This is a neuron that very early in the auditory system, in the cochlear nucleus, so it reflects quite directly the properties of hair cells. This neuron responded to frequencies mostly near 4 kilohertz. So this is a frequency axis, but you can think about it as a basilar membrane location. So this neuron is responsive to a certain location along the basilar membrane. Okay, and given its sensitivity to frequency, I can plot on the spectrogram, I can plot the area to which it should be the neuron should respond. Now, this is the response of the neuron to this chirp. And the sound starts below the sensitive area of the neuron and it goes then into the area that the neuron is sensitive to, and then the neuron responds. Okay, that's the response, increasing the firing rate of the neuron. Then it goes below the sensitive area, so the neuron stops responding and it goes in again. The neuron responds again. And then it goes a bit out and in again and the neuron responds again. So to a large extent, the neuron responds according to the amount of red that you have between these lines. Okay, this is precisely, it responds to the vibration of the basilar membrane in a restricted range of frequencies to which it is sensitive. In this sense, what the auditory periphery does is to give you a frequency decomposition, the same, this idea that Helmholtz introduced and got modified over the years. It's not exactly a spectrogram, it's not very far from a spectrogram. And this information, what this means is that the sound that we hear, Kathleen Ferrière with such beautiful voice, Okay, this sound is shattered into small bits. These bits go into the brain. Okay, none of these bits sounds like what we perceive at the end, and the brain, the thing between the ears, okay, uses these small bits to construct the object of perception, the piano, the viola, and the singer. Okay, now this information now flows into the brainstem. It goes through the cochlear nucleus, which is one of the best understood places in the whole nervous system. A lot of different cell types that are well characterized and have different functions that are well characterized. It goes then into regions in which sounds is compared between the two ears. Okay, these are the type of calculations that physicists like so much because they are so precise they would seem maybe to violate physics, as we heard before. Okay, this region compare, for example, sound level from the two ears. So a sound that comes from here would be a bit louder in this ear than in that ear. Or they compare the time. Sounds coming from here would arrive earlier to that ear than to that ear. These differences are minute. They may be, we are sensitive to order of 10 microseconds time differences between the two ears, but somehow the auditory system can find these. And finally, all of this information where physical features of sounds are calculated from these small bits of sound that, that were extracted in the inner ear, all of that information converges on a very large structure of the midbrain called the inferior colliculus. In this scheme, you see six arrows starting from one ear and going into the inferior colliculus. Some people count 70 different arrows, 70 different pathways, each of which calculates slightly different features of the sounds. All of that integrates at the level of the inferior colliculus. And now I'm studying the auditory system, but had I started today my studies of the auditory system, maybe I would go to understand what's going on in the inferior colliculus. To a large extent, the complexity of the auditory processing starts here. Okay, we understand pretty well, at least conceptually, what happens before, but the inferior colliculus is really complicated. What it has is a detailed multiparametric representation of sound. Multiparametric, exactly in the sense that I told you, a lot of different bits of the brainstem calculate a lot of different stuff and all goes into the inferior colliculus and is integrated there. I could probably bet that any difference between two sounds you can hear, I will find the neurons in the inferior colliculus that respond to them differently. Okay, in that sense, the inferior colliculus may be the neural basis of the hi-fi industry. I mean, the difference between a good loudspeaker and a wonderful loudspeaker is not very large, but sometimes it exists. And the inferior colliculus is the place where such differences are probably represented. So, to summarize my presentation up to this point, we have this low-level audition that has to do with the physical structure of sound. What these stations represent to a large extent is the vibration of the tympanic membrane. Not so much what we perceive, but what the physics of the sound is. Okay, we have pretty good models for understanding what's going on. We can simulate some of these things to surprising reliability. And as I tried to show you, we don't hear this part of the auditory system. And we have high-level audition, okay? That's what really interests us, the perceptual qualities of sound. We don't quite understand how this happens. It's introspectively highly accessible. Okay, and this leads me to try to tell you what I'm trying to explain. Okay, we hear the whole thing. So again, as an example, I can ask you, what did you hear? People laughing. How many? A few men, women? Both. Yeah, now all of that comes from this mess. Okay, looking at this, okay, I can't even tell you these are voices. Okay, maybe there are other people who are more talented than me in reading spectrograms who would be able to tell you. but I can't even tell you that these are human voices. So something, this transformation from the spectrogram to the perception is gives you a huge amount of information about the world. So what do I want to explain? We have this big in between. The term mid-level audition was introduced, at least to me, by Daniel Presnitzer from the Ecole Normale here. Okay, this idea that we need to explain the transformation that from the physical characteristics to the perceptual characteristics of sounds. Okay, we have relatively poor models for doing it. It's not introspectively accessible. It's a hard place. And to a large extent, I consider this as the equivalent of the interdisciplinary divide. This process sits here. Okay, exactly between these brain-related terms that have to do with the physical structure of sound and the perceptual concept that have to do with music. And to make this point even more strongly, I brought this quote from Einstein. This is the web version of the quote, but it's a real one. It comes from one of his letters to Max Born. It would be possible to describe everything scientifically, but it would make no sense. It would be without meaning, as if you described a Beethoven symphony as a variation of wave pressure. Now, I don't want to comment about scientific explanations. What I want to comment is about the metaphor that Einstein used here, and that's the Beethoven symphony as a variation in wave pressure. Okay, the problem I have, what strikes me with this metaphor, is the fact that this is what we do. The first time I heard Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, it was wave pressures in the air. Okay? After I heard it, there was a lot of stuff going on in addition. But this is what we do. We take wave pressure in the air and we make sense out of it. Okay? In fact, both the interdisciplinary divide and the Einsteinian problem are a kind of category problems. We try to link things that sort of don't belong to each other. And what for me, every time that I meet this, I need to invoke what I call the no magic principle. Okay? Everything we perceive, at least operatively, I believe that everything we perceive is a result of something in the biology of the brain. So this transformation has to be explained by brain activity. And over the last 15 or 20 years, when these ideas started forming, people, including me, including the group at the Ecole Normale and others, Josh McDermott, who has been presented here so beautifully in the previous talk, found a number of phenomena and concepts that seems to make this bridge possible. I will talk about one of them in detail, the coding of surprise, which is my own field of research. So I want to go now into a bit of, to tell you a bit about what's going on in the brain, how this construction process is happening. And I want to frame this as in the context of a kind of a paradox. Okay, and the paradox is the following: what we feel as low-level properties of sounds, okay, turned out to be represented pretty high in the auditory system, whereas what we would consider as high-level constructs are represented early. And I used as examples speech and surprise, but there are other pairs that could be contrasted. Okay, in principle, when you hear music, you imagine that first you extract the height of the notes, the pitch, okay, and then you construct the melodies, and then you extract out of that the fact that there's a phrase and there's tension and release and so on and so forth. Okay, what I will try to show you is it's almost the opposite. So let's start with speech. I hope I will not steal your thunder too much for the presentation. I'm really going to go over the issue of speech very, very superficially. Okay, so why is speech so important? Here's a list of basic features of a basic element of sound from a popular book. It's not that I agree with this list, but I had this book on my desk, so I just copied it. So loudness, you probably know what it is, pitch, contour, duration, or rhythm. This is kind of a mix but it doesn't matter. Tempo, timbre, spatial location, and reverberation. It's a bit, it's kind of a funny list, but that's fine. Okay, the thing is the pitch is a prominent feature of sound. I must tell you a story. A few years ago, we gave a course on music and brains at Hebrew University, and among the listeners was one of the most prominent musicologists at Hebrew University, Ruth Cohen, who studied the music, among other things, the music of the Samaritans, Jews, in the northern Israel. So I said, pitch is the thing with which you do music. She stood up and gave me a 5-minute harangue on why this is wrong. Okay, and the example that she gave was this music of the Samaritans, where they don't mind much about the pitch. They allow it to shift quite a bit, but they do mind a lot about vibrato, the rate of vibrato. So they do their music with vibrato, not with pitch. Okay, but we do most of our music with pitch. So here's the definition. Pitch is something with which you can order sounds on a scale from low to high and related to the frequency content of the sounds. There are some interesting things here. First of all, it's an auditory attribute. That's a perceptual quality. Okay? Pitch is not defined in terms of the physics of the sound, but in terms of what it does to you. And it is not an unsurprising fact that most people will judge the pitch of the same sound in the same way. Okay? It's not trivial. Now, a second property of this definition is that many different sounds evoke the same pitch. So pitch is a kind of an abstract property. It generalizes across a lot of different physics. For example, okay, so these are two, the same melody. Okay, physically, these are different things. And one of the properties that differ between them is the thing that we call timbre. But they have the same pitch. Now, it turns out that there is a physical property of sounds that is common to most sounds that evoke the same pitch, and this is periodicity. Okay, pitch is determined by the period of sound and not directly by the frequency content, and I want to illustrate this again. Here's a melody. Do you know it? Those of German descent certainly know it, but you should know that this is an Israeli children's song. So here's the same melody. Okay, sounds completely different. Here's the third version of the same melody. Okay, it's the same melody three times. Very, very different in terms of how it sounds like. And these are the waveforms. You can see that these waveforms is relatively slow. That one is relatively fast. This one is completely noisy. What is common to all of them is the fact that they have the periodicity. Okay, so this bit of the sound is the same as that one. This bit of the sound is the same as that one. Okay, that's the important, this is the important factor. And even with the noise, if you look carefully, okay, you can see that there are similarities between successive periods. Okay, so this negative pressure at the middle of the frame, or here, these two successive peaks toward the end of the period, or these things at the beginning. Okay, the way that this is generated is by creating a sound where each period is similar to the next one, but not necessarily to the one immediately afterwards. Okay, but this similarity between successive periods is enough for the auditory system to extract something that sounds like pitch. And most pitch that we encounter in real life is periodicity pitch. Okay, that's the large majority of the thing that we call pitch is really this kind of pitch. So how does the brain extract pitch? The basic fact is very simple. If you repeatedly excite the auditory system with the same bit of sound, you will repeatedly evoke the same response. Okay, so for example, here I have two periods of a sound, and these things represent action potentials in the, let's say, in an auditory nerve fiber. And since the sound here and the sound here were the same, okay, these two sequences of action potentials are similar to each other. So what I can do is simply estimate the intervals between each spike that occurred here with each spike that occurred before. Okay, and many of these intervals are going to be between matching spikes that occurred by because of the same bit of sound. And so I will have a larger presentation of the interval that corresponds to the pitch. Okay, so that's hand waving, a fast explanation of how this happens. This interval code is present. You can extract pitch using this type of code from recordings in the auditory nerve. And it is enhanced in the brainstem by different mechanisms. Again, to remind you, the brainstem is this bit of brain that where I told you that there's a lot of extraction of physical properties of sounds. And this activity in the brainstem is so strong, you can actually see it with EEG recordings. So this is an example of work from the lab of Nina Kraus. They presented a sound that has starts, go down in frequency, and then go up in frequency again. What you see here is not a sound. What you see here is EEG recorded from, evoked, we know that it comes from the brainstem of a musician. It is highly periodic, and if you look at this period, the period, okay, it follows very nicely the pitch of the sound. Okay, and the point of this study is the fact that these frequency following responses are much stronger in musicians than in non-musicians. That's a different story, but the important thing to know, to understand is that this is not pitch representation. The pitch itself is not represented. What is represented is the fact that there are some repeated intervals within the sequence. If instead of equal intervals, I will put in variable intervals, this thing will represent the variable intervals. Okay, this is a substrate out of which higher areas of the brain can do the calculations that are necessary in order to extract the pitch. So pitch is not represented at the level of the auditory nerve. Where it is, where we know it is represented is above, at auditory cortex or above. So this is again, this comes from a very influential study from the lab of Roy Patterson in Cambridge. What you see here are cuts through the brain. This is posterior, this is anterior. Auditory cortex is around here. This whitish area represents what is believed to be primary auditory cortex in the humans. And this is a functional imaging study. So what they did was to present a lot of different sounds, and they excited this area that's marked in blue. It includes primary auditory cortex and surrounding fields. And then they took the sound and roughly equalized all its other properties except the fact that it had pitch. And once they did that, they got extra activity in this lateral area that's slightly away from primary auditory cortex. So one of the candidates, it's not, there's a lot of work that was done since, but one of the candidates for being the cortex that's sensitive to pitch is this area, lateral Heschel gyrus, which is already non-primary auditory cortex, above primary auditory cortex. So representations of pitch emerge at or above primary auditory cortex, of course, based on cues extracted by lower stations. Again, no magic. If you know something in the cortex, it, information about it was already present before. Okay, and this is pitch. Okay, pitch, again, is one of the most direct things that we know about sounds. So I want now to go over the other half of the paradox, which is surprise. High-level constructs are represented early in the auditory system. So first of all, a few words about expectations and surprise in the brains. What we do in order to study surprise is to create expectations and violate them. That's easy. Okay, we can do it in many different ways. We see whether there's electricity coming out of the brain because of the violation. And if there is, we can conclude that the brain formed an expectation. Now, there's a whole zoo of surprise responses in the human brain. I'll show you a few of these. The most, probably the most famous one and the one that most relevant to us is called mismatch negativity. So this is Leon Deruel. He's a professor of psychology at Hebrew University, and I stole these slides from him. So you present a sequence of sounds. There are two sounds. One of them occurs a lot, and the other one is rare. Okay, it's a pretty boring experiment. And then you separately average the brain responses to the sound that's common. We call it a standard. And the sound that's rare, which we call as deviant. Okay, and what you find is that the response to a deviant is slightly more negative than the response to the standard. And this extra negativity has to do with the fact that the sound was unexpected. I will show you some evidence for that in a moment. Okay, we have other things. P300, for example, is a much larger wave that is evoked by deviants that are to which we have to pay attention. N400 is a potential that's evoked by semantic violation. So, for example, a sentence like this, he shaved off his mustache and city. So city is unrelated to the context. And when it appears either visually or auditorily, you will have this N400 potential. P600, even more complex things, has to do with reevaluation of previous information. Okay, this is usually evoked by something called garden path sentences. Here's a French example. Okay, when Le Voile occurred, you had to reanalyze, reinterpret La Petite Ferme. Okay, this was presumably considered by most of you as a noun, ferme as a noun. And after you see the end of the sentence, ferme becomes a verb. Okay, these are called garden path sentences because, like in a garden, they go like this. Okay, here's an English example. Okay, same character. Man here is not a noun, it's a verb. Okay, I had also a version in Hebrew, but I will not show it to you in order not to annoy the few of you who don't speak Hebrew. So, okay. So here's there are all of these examples of surprise responses in the brain, and they're also evoked by music. So here's an example. This is from the work of the group of Stefan Kölsch in Berlin. So this is a phrase that has been almost taken from a chorale by Bach. The exact version is this. Do you hear the difference? Some of you will and some of you won't. Okay, this depends a bit on musical sophistication. The last chord is different. It's tonic in both cases, but it's first degree in one and sixth degree in the other. And a kind of a movement to a tonic using the sixth degree chord is unstable. Okay, it's not as stable as finishing the phrase on the first degree, and it requires continuation. Now, it turns out that Bach, most of the cadences in Bach pieces are like that, the stable ones on the first degree, and 95% from the ending in the chorales are like this, and 5% are like this. So this is a rare ending. Okay? And it is used by Bach for special effects, okay, for almost, but not quite, finishing a sentence. However, since the difference is small, they also use this. I'm sure that was unexpected. And indeed, there's electricity coming out of the brain when these unexpected endings come. This is for the very unexpected endings. Here, these guys plot negativity up, so the negative potential that's quite similar but not exactly, and mismatch negativity occurs here for the difference between the highly unexpected and the expected endings. For the difference between the unexpected and a bit unexpected ending, the difference is smaller, but it's significant. So these surprises affect are relevant for music, not only in terms of regularities that have to do with our knowledge of the harmonic sequence, but also for regularities that are created within the sequence. And again, I want to illustrate this. You will hear now a sound sequence that's composed of four different sounds. There's high and low, and there's long and short. Okay, so each sound can be either high and short, high and long, low and short, low and long. There is a regularity here. There's a rule. Okay, and I want you to try to find out the rule. Anyone can guess? Okay, so here's the rule. Shut up. Okay. If you have a high tone, you have a long tone. If you have a high tone, you have a long tone. If you have a short tone, you have a long tone afterwards. And if you have a low tone, you have a short tone afterwards. Okay, so this is a long tone with a short tone afterwards. That a short tone with a low tone afterwards, okay, then a long tone, okay, with a short, and so on and so forth. Okay, pretty complicated. These are the deviants. Now, the point is that no one of the people who were tested here could identify the regularity, and even after they have been shown the regularity, okay, they couldn't find deviants in the sequence. However, if you recorded in the evoked potential recorded from their brain, there was a mismatch negativity. So the response to the deviants was slightly more negative than the response to standard. Okay, so somehow, although explicitly these people could not say what the regularity is, somehow their brain knew that there is a regularity and weakly responded to it. So can we observe similar phenomena in real neurons, and real neurons usually mean not in human brains? Okay, so this is work that runs in my lab now for over 10 years. What I will show you are so-called intracellular recordings. This is actually a slice, a brain slice, and what you see here is the cell body. We use electrodes that go into that actually stick into the neuron, and we can see the membrane potential, the electricity in the neuron varying, and the action potential that are getting formed. This is how a recording looks like. Okay, this is a raw trace, 140 seconds of recordings. The color differentiates between what we call the subthreshold membrane fluctuations and these short events that are more rare, that are the action potentials. If I just take a bit of that, you can see the fluctuation of the membrane potential. Okay, and sometimes the neurons decide to emit this very fast thing called an action potential. The action potentials are the things that go to the next neurons. Okay, and now this is a recording from the brain of an anesthetized rat. Okay, all the data I will show you are from anesthetized rats here. So we use these oddball sequences composed of two sounds. One of them is common, the other one is rare. Again, it sounds like this. Okay, and much of the difference between what we actually play in the experiment and what you heard now has to do with the fact that rats hear higher frequencies. So very often you will see here frequencies of 20 kilohertz, 40 kilohertz, okay, which we can't hear. But otherwise, this is pretty much what happens in an experiment. So what I show here is the raw membrane potential trace with action potentials. This is a standard, okay, prescinding a deviant, and the next standard. Now, this standard did not evoke an activity. The deviant did evoke a response and with an action potential riding on top of that, and the next standard may be. Okay, that's the next standard, next deviant. Again, the deviant evoked this blob. The standard, I can tell you that this action potential was not evoked by the tone. There are reasons to, a way to determine this. Okay, again, this tone did not evoke an action potential, but we have this blip that is evoked by the deviant, and so on and so forth. If we take all of our standards and all of our deviants together, okay, you can see that whereas standards did not evoke much activity, the deviant evoked something that was pretty reproducible from one presentation to the next. So these neurons, what I'm showing here now is the average membrane potential in response to the tone that was standard and in response to the tone that was deviant, and this response is larger than that. Okay, now this is not enough in order to claim that the response was a response to the rarity of the rare sound, and the reason is that these are two different frequencies and the neuron like frequencies to different degrees. Okay, so what we do is to switch the roles of the two frequencies. We play a sequence that's composed of the two tones, but now we switch the roles. The lower one, lower frequency one, which was rare, becomes the common, and vice versa. And we have the responses in that block, and then we always compare the responses to the same sound, okay, when it's common and when it's rare. Okay, and it's essentially always, this is biology, so essentially always is 90% of the cases. Okay, the response to the same sound when common is less than the response to the same sound when rare, and this is true independent of the signal that we are using. These are intracellular recordings. We can use a spiking activity, the spike rates. We can use population responses, local field potentials. It doesn't matter. Okay, in all of them. In primary auditory cortex, we see this effect. So we use also a block of control where the two tones are 50% occur 50% randomly, and so we get something that looks like, if you wish, a probability response function for a neuron. Okay, the less common the sound, the larger the responses, and the effect here, the differences between the response to a sound when rare and the response to the sound when common, are relatively large to other things we can do to the neuron. We can change level, we can change frequency. Okay, we need to change the frequency quite a lot in order to get differences in response that are large like that. So it's a quite a strong way of modulating the responses of the neurons. Now, this sensitivity to rarity turns out to occur first in this inferior colliculus, this structure, this interesting structure that I mentioned briefly before. Okay. At the earliest stages of the central auditory pathway in the cochlear nucleus, it was not found. It exists in some part of the inferior colliculus, not everywhere, in some part of the auditory thalamus, and essentially everywhere in cortex. So this sensitivity occurs very early. Now, you could say that's pretty trivial, common versus rare, adaptation, all kinds of things like that. So I want to show you a bit of data that suggests that this really goes deeper than that. We used sequences in which the tones had the same probabilities, but where the sequences were more or less regular. So here you have a rare tone with a probability of 25%. It occurs one every fourth sound. Here it's one every fourth sound on average, and here it is one every fourth sound exactly. Okay, so these are periodic sequences and these are random sequences. Okay, now we can play these type of sequences again. This is a red auditory cortex. So we have the periodic sequences. Here in this illustration, probability of the rare sound is 20%. Okay, it occurs every fifth position, either exactly in the periodic sound or on average in the random sequence. And if we look at the responses, okay, the response to the same sound, in this case, I'm showing the response to the common sound, but same thing happens for the rare sounds. The response to the sound in the periodic ordered version of the sequence is smaller than in the random version of the sequence. Okay, now we had this result and we went, by the way, you can see the high frequencies. Okay, so here the two frequencies we used were 21.7 and 31.2 kilohertz above the hearing range of humans. When we tried to publish this for the first time, the reviewer said this is a nice result, but if you would get the opposite result, you would also try to publish it. So what's going on? Okay, try to explain what's going on. And we eventually converged on something that we call the interdeviant interval distribution. So what's interdeviant intervals? It's just the number of tones between successive deviants. Okay, here it is 4. Okay, so this is one deviant, and then we have 1, 2, 3, and the fourth one is again a deviant. Okay, here it is 7. Okay, and in the periodic sequence, in this example, it's always 5. Okay, so in a sense, the interdeviant interval distribution here is simpler than here. Okay, so what we did was to manipulate the complexity of the interdeviant interval distribution. For a periodic sequence, in our case, the probability of the deviant was 5%. So in a periodic sequence, we had 19 standard followed by a deviant, 19 standard followed by a deviant, and so on. Okay, so the interdeviant distribution was all 20. Okay, and then we had sequences in which we had half of the interdeviant intervals 10 standard and the other one 30, or sequences in which we had 4 different values for the interdeviant interval with the same average, and so on and so forth. It turns out that the responses to a sequence are larger when it is more varied, when the interdeviant interval distribution is more varied. So if you compare that sequence, which has 24 different intervals, with this one, which has only one, the responses are larger to the sequence that's more varied. Okay, again here, this one has 4 different values, that one has 24 different values, and again, the response is larger for the more varied sequence, and so on. Okay, and that's the summary of this study. On the x-axis, we have the number of different interdeviant intervals. So this is roughly the complexity, some measure for the complexity of the sequence. And on the y-axis, we have the response. And the larger the complexity of the sequence, the larger the responses are. So these are anesthetized rats. Okay, they know at least to count up to 20. Okay, and they know to count up to 20 at least twice, okay, because they know whether the sequence is periodic or not. And this is primary auditory cortex, so this is before pitch emerged. So this is kind of funny, the immediate direct sensory property is represented higher up than something that's maybe we consider as less elementary. And I want to give you one framework. It's not a solution, but at least it is a framework with which we can evaluate these type of phenomena. And this is the idea of hierarchies and reverse hierarchies. This comes from the work of Shaul Hochstein and Merav Achisar at Hebrew University, and it was initially developed to account for visual effects. So the idea is that you have an ascending hierarchy of processing that starts with simple features and go to more complex and more complex and more complex, and you end up with a representation of complex stuff. The thing about the heart of the reverse hierarchy theory says that perception actually goes in the opposite direction. So we first perceive at these levels. Okay, the conscious perception starts at the high level, okay, and then goes back, if necessary, to the details. Okay, one consequence of this is that we will usually be sensitive to the big picture and we will not see the details. Okay, so here's an example. How many of you can see the thing that's wrong in the sentence? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you see the second thing that's wrong with this sentence? Okay. So this is called repetition blindness. Okay, it has been studied by Nancy Kanwisher many years ago. So the word is repeats twice and the word when repeats twice. But we tend not to see it. Okay, here's another example that's a Parisian example. Okay, there are two pictures that, that are interleaved. Can you see what's different between them? Okay, it takes, for many people, it takes some time. Okay, although it's a pretty prominent piece of the okay, it's the church, the Notre Dame that moves left and right. Okay, so this is a change blindness that has been studied by Kevin O'Regan, again here at the Col Normal. Okay, I'll skip. The idea is that in addition, there should be a similar hierarchy. We start by extracting physical features, then we get the more abstract representations, like a representation of a feature like a pitch, and this is where we start perceiving. Okay, this is why pitch is immediate, and the other properties, you don't hear your ear. Okay, your ear is here. Okay, it's the physical structure of things, and you perceive the high-level stuff. If necessary, if we push you, you know, experimentally, then we can get you to hear these lower-level stuff. So I want to finish by being a bit maybe more concrete about the relationship between sound and music in the auditory system. Okay, all of that was a bit speculative. So one thing that we did at some point was to record responses to actual music in anesthetized rat brains. Now, we couldn't do it with Bach chorales because we can't hope that the rats have understanding of Western harmonic language. And eventually, we discovered this collection of pieces by Gheorghe Ligeti called Musica Ricercata. This is quite minimal music. There are 11 pieces. The first uses only two pitch classes. It has a D and an A, okay, a La and a Re. The second one, which we used, has three notes, okay, and E sharp, F sharp, and G, okay, the whole thing. Okay, that's the one that we used, and so on. The 11th has all 12 pitch classes of the scale. And it's an extremely beautiful set of pieces, highly recommended to listen to it. I'll play a bit of the piece. So it starts with this motif that uses only the E sharp and the F sharp. Goes on and on for about 2 minutes. I'm sorry, it's very beautiful, but. And then, so we hear for 2 minutes, we hear only F sharp and E sharp, okay? And then comes the next note, the G. This is a kind of a counter theme, the G, and then you have a development where the two themes are played against each other. We needed to adapt this to Rett's auditory system. The whole thing got shifted by one octave. We got a pianist to play it for us, a real pianist, not me. And she played it on electrified piano, so we got also the MIDI notation of what she played. Okay, this is the spectrogram of the acoustic recording. The important, the part I'm going to emphasize is the part, this middle part where the geocur and this development section where the two themes go against each other. So these are the G's, okay? This is the first G with its first harmonic and so on. Here we have this repetition, E sharp, F sharp, F sharp, E sharp, E sharp, F sharp, G. Okay, now the reason that I'm showing it to you is to make the point that the frequency differences between these three notes are small. Okay, a semitone, okay, that's about 6% in frequency, and the tuning curve of neurons in rat auditory cortex are substantially wider than that. So as far as the neurons are concerned, these frequency components, if they fall within their excitatory area, all of the three would fall within their excitatory area. Okay, and then Yael Bitterman, who analyzed this data, took each one of the notes, extracted its peak amplitude, and we recorded the responses to these sounds in the brain, again, auditory cortex of rats. So you see that there are nice responses that in the local field potential, that's the EEG-like signal that we extract from the electrode. Okay, if we average the local field potentials across a lot of recording sites and a number of animals, you can see the responses to this middle part. Okay, same thing with the spiking activity. Okay, these are two different ways of measuring the responses, but both of them provide a similar answer. And here's just this middle part extracted, is about 50 seconds worth of music that are extracted from the whole thing. So this is the response to the first presentation of the G, the second, then it goes and becomes faster and faster. Okay, and the green dots represent responses to E sharps and F sharps. Okay, and the reds are the response to the G, and the circled, circled reds are the what Yael called the most surprising G's, those that occurred after other notes. Okay, and already just looking here at the local field potentials or at the unit activity, you can see that these most surprising G's are actually pretty effective at evoking activity. So here Yael plotted on the x-axis the sound level peak and on the y-axis the neural responses. Okay, and as you can see, these G's evoked responses that are larger than expected given their level, and the most surprising G's are the most effective at evoking these responses. Okay, and finally, she made a kind of a joint measure of the sound level and the probability of the sound, which seems to explain best the responses, but this is really not the point. Okay, the point is, of the story is this. Okay, the fact that these G's evoke a response that's larger than expected by their level, presumably because they are surprising. And again, these are responses in anesthetized rats. Okay, so a disclaimer. I didn't show that Ligeti wrote music for rats. I didn't explain to you why we enjoy music using responses from anesthetized rats. And I certainly didn't explain how music affects the human brain. Okay, what I'm trying to argue, okay, is that this is one step. There's a lot of work to do here before this can be made fully convincing. But Ligeti's maneuver, the fact that he had these two themes, one of them based on two notes and the other one on the third one, works, and it works so well because it uses a mechanism that is generally available to the mammalian brain. Okay, now these mechanisms have been used later in order to make music really something that's so specially human. But some of the mechanisms that composers use to manipulate you, okay, are actually manipulating mechanisms that are generally mammalian. So a couple of final comments. We didn't get a definition of music, so here's a definition of music by a composer. Okay, Edgar Varèse, I don't know if you know him, but his music from the first half of the 20th century is very much a lot of noise, organized. And when he was pushed about what he's doing, he said that music is organized sound. In this sense, Okay, to the extent that music is organized sound, okay, what I tried to show you is that organization actually comes first. Okay, and the sounds are created later, at the same time or later than the organization. And to some extent, this is a way of resolving, or at least thinking, about this Einsteinian problem. Okay, what we do when there's a pressure, sound pressure in the wave, we don't encode the sound pressure. Okay, what our brain does is extract structure. Okay, and this is what gives meaning to Beethoven. And by now, I probably exhausted your patience, and I'm exhausted physically, and thank you.